Deer breeders in the Texas Hill Country are bracing for test results that may force them to destroy their herds at the most lucrative time of the season. I'm Shelley Kaufler, and this is Fronteras, a public radio program about issues along the Texas-Mexico border and changing demographics in the Southwest. This week, Texas Parks and Wildlife euthanized 35 deer taken from a ranch in Medina County. Chronic wasting disease was recently discovered at the ranch, and state officials want to know if it's spreading to other animals. Hundreds of ranchers who breed deer are concerned they'll also lose their herds, and the state's $2 billion industry will be ruined. State officials say they want to prevent chronic wasting disease from moving beyond the captive deer population to animals in the wild. Texas Public Radio's Ryan Poppy traveled to the heart of deer country, where breeders wait anxiously for what comes next.
Near Junction, a two-hour drive northwest of San Antonio, is the Perfect 10 Whitetail Deer Ranch. It's a high-fenced-in facility that uses genetics to breed big bucks with giant antlers. They're sold to hunting businesses for up to $30,000 a deer.
Bottle raise our babies and, of course, you know, run them through the chutes and work them and everything else.
Inside the ranch's nursery for baby fawns, owner David Grainer is fearful about what will happen to his business, which raises close to 340 deer a year. Texas Parks and Wildlife is trying to prevent the spread of chronic wasting disease, or CWD, which infects a deer's brain, telling the animal to stop eating.
Up north, when CWD breaks out, they go in and usually decimate the herd, and they come back with very little, if any, CWD. So here they've killed all these animals for no really good reason.
Grainer's afraid herds could also be wiped out in Texas as officials try to contain the disease. The state's current test for the disease can only be used on a dead deer.
There is a live test that is available. It at least gives you an opportunity to save your herd. I have nothing other than the deer and the hunting. It's just really what we do out here.
Grainer's not alone in his worries. The deer breeding ranch is just one of 1,300 in Texas which is currently prohibited from selling its deer. The moratorium on moving or selling captive deer began earlier this month after state officials learned that a two-year-old deer at the Texas Mountain Ranch in Medina County had tested positive for the disease. Steve Lightfoot with the Texas Parks and Wildlife says the agency acted swiftly because the disease can spread quickly.
Among deer and elk, it can spread easily from nose-to-nose contact. It can stay in the environment for long periods of time. The issue is that it doesn't show physical symptoms right away, so it can be incubating for a number of years before anything occurs.
Lightfoot says that's significant, because this is the first time the state has identified a white-tailed deer with wasting disease that was bred in captivity. Up until now, the disease has only shown up in Texas in the mule deer population, which is non-migratory.
We immediately restricted movement of all captive deer in Texas until we could do a risk assessment and determine the prevalence of this disease, whether it was isolated to this one herd, which we consider the index herd, the source of the disease, or whether it may have spread to other facilities.
Wildlife experts are concerned the disease could jump from breeder facilities into the wild and infect the state's 4 million free-roaming deer. State Representative Andrew Murr, a Junction Republican, has a large number of deer hunting and breeding ranches in his district and sits on a House committee looking at the problem. He's urging breeders to stay calm.
As of this week, and you probably are familiar with, that moratorium is being lifted on certain permittees, depending on whether or not they've had any contact up or down with a trace in or a trace out of the index test sample, which came from Medina County.
In other words, ranches that can prove that they've had no contact with the diseased deer can resume selling their animals. But with the two largest deer auctions scheduled in August just before the start of hunting season, tensions among deer breeders like Grainer is running high. This is the most lucrative part of the year.
And most people don't have their buyers even lined up yet, because who is going to put a deposit on deer to buy if they don't think you're going to be able to move them? And then they've screwed themselves out of possibly buying from somebody else who maybe is able to move them.
Seated in an all-terrain vehicle, Grainer passes rows of pens filled with deer. He's still hoping to auction his best stags at the state's auction in San Antonio in a couple of weeks.
State officials say deer cannot transmit chronic wasting disease to humans, but they're still cautioning people not to eat the meat of a diseased deer. Now to another issue that inflames passions in the Southwest, gun rights. As we've reported, beginning in January, licensed owners in Texas can openly carry their handguns in public. And later next year, owners can carry concealed handguns on state university campuses. There are, however, a few areas that remain off limits, including hospitals. Some Second Amendment activists want to change that, too. KERA's Lawrence Silverman reports, a North Texas representative believes staff and visitors to hospitals should be able to carry firearms for self-defense.
A few years ago, when State Representative Drew Springer went to visit a deputy at a Fort Worth hospital, he had to leave his gun in his car.
I go up and see the deputy, and then I come back, and now I leave where the security guard is, and I spend the next 10 minutes walking in a dark parking lot to get to my car in downtown Fort Worth, and I absolutely did not feel safe.
Springer says it makes no sense. He can take his gun into the Capitol building, but has to leave it in the glove compartment before walking into the ER. So the representative proposed a bill to eliminate most gun-free zones in the state. His district stretches over several counties between Amarillo and Dallas-Fort Worth, and it includes more than a dozen hospitals.
I've had both employees as well as visitors of their loved ones that have said, we're right here on the interstate. There's a big sign that says hospital, and people are coming off and trying to rob them of their drugs, and they feel vulnerable, and they want the right to be able to protect themselves.
Police Captain Dan Burbeck is also a Second Amendment supporter, but says guns should be off limits in hospitals. He's responsible for the team that responds to emergencies in the Dallas County Hospital District.
I totally understand the public's want or need to be able to defend themselves. However, I think there needs to be some common sense built into this as well.
Burbeck says Parkland, like many other major hospitals, treats a large number of psychiatric patients who may be in danger of hurting themselves or others.
With open carry or concealed carry, you have a well-intentioned patient coming in, sitting next to psych patients and prisoners, and you've introduced a gun into that environment. Even though that person, may have a right to defend themselves, they don't have the right to place others in danger.
Which is exactly what happened several years ago when Parkland doctors were treating a prisoner.
He ended up overpowering a deputy sheriff and was able to take his firearm.
After a large manhunt, a SWAT team eventually took the prisoner into custody. More recently, in January, a shooting at a Veterans Affairs clinic in El Paso left a psychologist and the gunman dead. In April, a father visiting his son at a hospital in Harris County pulled a gun on a nurse. In that incident, no one was hurt. Still, these cases bring up safety concerns for staff and visitors. In fact, new research released by the Occupational Safety and Health Administration shows staff working in hospitals experience much higher rates of workplace violence. The solution, says Steve Love with the Dallas-Fort Worth Hospital Council, isn't more weapons.
All people that I know within the hospital community clearly want gun-free zones in their hospitals.
Love says there's already violence without guns.
Unfortunately, a couple of years ago, and this wasn't even a gun, we had a nurse at the Good Shepherd Hospital over in Longview lose her life, where she was killed with a knife by a visitor in a hospital.
Hospitals across North Texas train for violence like active shooter incidents. Here's Police Captain Dan Burbeck.
If we were to have somebody enter the hospital with a gun with, their objectives or intention is to kill people or shoot people, we have non-ambulatory patients that can't defend themselves. We have patients that are ill and unable to defend themselves. So we try to prepare so that we can protect as many of our patient population as possible.
Lawmaker Drew Springer says he's willing to negotiate the details of guns in hospitals, but he doesn't plan to drop the issue. For Fronteras, I'm Lauren Silverman.
Heading west to New Mexico now, there's a pollution problem that's lingered there for more than three decades. During the Cold War, the Navajo Nation found itself in the middle of a uranium mining boom. Today, more than 500 mines on the reservation are shut down or abandoned. But KUNM's Ed Williams reports the pollution they left behind was never cleaned up. And residents say they need help.
A little over 100 people live in the Redwater Pond Road community in northwestern New Mexico. It's a modest enclave of trailers and barns tucked into a cluster of rugged, scenic mesas. On the surface, things look pretty ordinary, but there's something going on here that's not normal at all.
And they said it was next to Chernobyl.
It's Bertha Nez. We're looking out over the rocky landscape at the site of one of the worst nuclear disasters in U.S. history. The cleanup area stretches across the horizon. There are whole hillsides made of mine waste and fences to keep kids and livestock out. Edith Hood is Nez's sister.
We heard of that Three Mile Island, too. This is about the same, but that was cleaned up. This was not. Like, if not, if this was somewhere in a city near Washington, D.C., it would be cleaned up quickly.
Starting in the 1960s, three mining companies set up shop within a mile or so of Redwater Pond Road, where for years they tunneled for uranium for nuclear weapons. Then, on July 16, 1979, a tailings dam gave way, spilling millions of gallons of radioactive sludge into a canyon where tribal members grazed their livestock. Today, the United Nuclear Church Rock spill and the two other now-abandoned mines are EPA Superfund sites. But for years, locals didn't know the area was dangerous.
And my parents live in this house right here. They're both gone now, and it's just like...
They used to gather stuff from the mine, huh?
Mm-hmm.
You know, contaminate it.
Well, at that time, we didn't know they were contaminated.
Cleaning up that contamination has been a long and complicated process, says Clancy Tinley with the EPA.
I think it's the most challenging uranium mine cleanup probably that we'll do on the reservation.
Challenging because of the sheer amount of pollution. Plus, each step in the cleanup has to go through a complex regulatory process with the EPA, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and the Navajo Nation. That process has been going on for decades and is still a long way from being done. The EPA has relocated families before. Now they're again offering to move people from Redwater Pond Road.
The relocations are voluntary. We're offering it because we know that there'll be a lot of disruption during the cleanup. And so we've let the residents know that if they'd like to move out during the cleanup, we'll do what we can to make that happen.
And that has become a sticking point for the community. They say they can't just up and leave. This is their homeland. They're willing to move to a nearby mesa. Trouble is, the government can only relocate people to places with infrastructure like roads and electricity. But there's nowhere on this community's ancestral land that meets those requirements.
These are the kinds of problems that require thinking outside of the box.
Chris Shuey with the Southwest Research and Information Center has been advocating for the Redwater Pond Road community for decades. He says the EPA's current relocation policy shouldn't stop the agency and the companies responsible for the mess from coming up with a way to keep the families on their land.
The people need justice in the community. They need a plan that removes them and their progeny from these exposures for as long as it takes to get those sites cleaned up. And we could be talking another 20 years. That's another generation.
For now, Edith Hood and Bertha Nez say unless they can be relocated nearby, next time the cleanup crews come, they're not going anywhere.
No. I choose to remain here.
And in spite of the looming uncertainty, they're building a traditional Navajo hogan where the community can gather for neighborhood meetings or religious ceremonies.
In the Navajo culture, you're already tied to the land when you're born, because in Navajo they take that umbilical cord from you and they bury it with where you live, like where the livestock is. And they pray that you always come back here because of that, that you're, you know, just rooted to the land.
That connection to the land, she says, is just too strong for any nuclear disaster to break. Reporting from Albuquerque, I'm Ed Williams.
Coming next on Fronteras, there's a lot of buzz about the latest weapon in border security and the debate on whether Texas should eliminate mandates for producing wind energy.
Wind has a really good foothold in Texas, and it's time for them really to start operating without subsidies.
Those stories after this. This is Fronteras, and I'm Shelley Koffler. In South Texas, a French wasp has become the new weapon in border security. It likes to nest in carrizo, which is a bamboo-like reed that can grow 30 feet tall. Border Patrol agents refer to the cane as Sherwood Forest, making it a great hiding place for migrants crossing into the state. Searching the thick cane has become frustratingly futile for agents and their patrol dogs. Attempts to get rid of the weed, burning, bulldozing, cutting, haven't destroyed it. Now a Department of Agriculture entomologist wants to kill the carrizo cane biologically with the help of the Arundo wasp from France. The wasp is about the size of a pinhead. It lays eggs in the carrizo, and once the larvae hatch, they slice through the plant's fibers, and that stunts the growth. Now here's something else you might not know. Texas leads the nation in wind power production, at least for now. The state is flirting with the notion, however, of completely eliminating its renewable energy mandates, which forces utilities to generate some of their power from solar and wind. That's just the opposite of what's happening in California, where lawmakers want to expand the amount of renewable energy being produced. The push in Texas to relax renewable energy requirements is alarming some investors who want Texas to be an industry leader in the Southwest. Frontera's reporter Lauren Madelon of Marfa Public Radio has the story.
Wind power is in Texas for two reasons: open space for turbines, and a pro-business culture that's loved energy development since the arrival of oil and gas. That wind is high-stakes commerce in the flatlands of West Texas. Wind is fanning turbines operated by North Carolina-based Duke Energy Renewables. Some of Duke's wind power ends up here at an Austin institution called Taco Deli.
Can I get a 4-ounce Roja?
4-ounce Roja!
The deli buys wind power from the city utility, Austin Energy, which gets it from Duke. The utility's customers, like deli co-owner Eric Wilkerson, can opt to buy 100% wind-generated electricity. He made that choice in 2005.
The price at that time was a little bit higher than conventional electricity, but we were locked in at that price.
So Wilkerson could look ahead knowing one critical business expense wouldn't fluctuate.
We were able to budget and have the comfort, this is what our energy costs will be.
In 1999, Texas told utilities, put renewable energy into your portfolio. Texans also started paying about 9 more cents a month for electricity. That subsidized transmission lines built specifically to bring wind onto the grid. Texas now gets 10% of its power from wind. But this past March, a challenge in the state legislature.
City Committee on Natural Resources and Economic Development will come to order.
That's Texas Republican State Senator Troy Fraser in hearings on the renewable energy portfolio. He doesn't think Texas needs it.
There's no message here other than God will say it. Mission accomplished. We're going to remove that.
Fraser's bill to repeal the renewables mandate passed in the state Senate. It wasn't considered by the House, so it didn't become law. But the conversation he started continues.
Why do you need to leave a requirement in place when we have far surpassed that requirement?
The chief electricity regulator in Texas is Donna Nelson. She's chairman of the state's Public Utilities Commission.
Wind has a really good foothold in Texas, and it's time for them really to start operating without subsidies.
That free market mantra is embraced by many in conservative Texas and elsewhere. This year, 5 other states have introduced legislation to reduce renewable mandates. But the End Subsidies Now movement is disconcerting for the wind business. Jeff Clark leads the lobby group called the Wind Coalition.
Our phone immediately started ringing.
That was when Fraser's bill passed in the state Senate.
Investors all over the world were looking at Texas and saying, are the policies going to change? Is my investment, is my long-term planning, my long-term investment a sound one in that state?
Clark says his membership needs the same kinds of support that oil and gas have long had in Texas, and no one is challenging those. One example, the state comptroller's office says natural gas producers saved $7 billion in the last 6 years because of exemptions in the tax code.
Our competitors have long-term certainty in the tax code. They have long-term certainty in their subsidies. They have long-term certainty in their access to capital on Wall Street. We have none of those things.
To get a better handle on the uncertainties of the wind market, we went to the University of Texas at Austin. Ian Partridge is a fellow at the school's Energy Institute.
I think if you look at what Texas has done, it's essentially been a combination of private investment in wind generation and public investment in the transmission system. That's something that other states really should copy.
This summer, the EPA will finalize its Clean Power Plan. It will pressure states to look for increasing amounts of renewables.
If states are going to comply with the requirements of that plan, they're going to need to somehow incentivize much larger levels of renewable generation.
This same debate is playing out in Congress. In May, Republican Texas Congressman Kenny Marchant introduced legislation to permanently end federal subsidies that have meant billions for wind power. The subsidy was allowed to expire last year, and not for the first time. But in his latest budget, President Obama proposes to make that subsidy permanent. Steve Scott is the general manager of Duke Energy's wind operations.
Those of us in the market strongly feel that there is more importance on long-term stability as opposed to stops and starts. It is better for the industry if we have certainty around what that future is. And unfortunately, with each administration, there's a different spin on the energy policy. And that's something that we want to get away from.
Even wind supporters say that one day, perhaps within a decade, they won't need subsidies. But opponents say that wind's exponential growth means that day's already arrived. I'm Lorne Madelon.
And that's it for Fronteras this week and our stories from the Southwest. You can find this show under the Programs tab on our website, tpr.org. Alexis Yancey produced this broadcast. Taronga Cakewalk composed our theme music. I'm Shelley Koffler in San Antonio.